Buongiorno a tutti, mi potete sentire? Benissimo. Grazie mille di essere qui in questo sabato mattina. Io sono Giovanna Madasi, mi occupo dei programmi culturali e istituzionali di Pirelli Engarbicocca e sono felice e veramente onorata di avere vicino a me Jessica Morgan, direttrice della Dia Foundation for the Arts di New York e Sheila Gowda. I will now repeat in English because I know most of the audience is not speaking Italian, and the talk will be in English. So I'm very honored to introduce you to the talk From Distance to Intimacy, which is not really a talk, it's like a stroll through the exhibition Remains with Jessica Morgan, director of Dia Center for the Arts, Dia Foundation actually, in New York, and Sheila Gowda, the artist of the show, a beautiful show curated by Nuria Anghita and Lucia Aspesi, who are here with us now. And the idea is really to put you in direct relationship with the works of the exhibition, please, Nuria and Lucia, and to put you in direct relation with the works of Sheila, who are really have a very strong relationship with the body and with the visitor. So we thought that instead of having a talk seated in a space, it was much nicer to have the possibility to really be immersed in this amazing exhibition. And Jessica Morgan has a very strong relationship with the work of Sheila Gowda. She was the one who acquired the work Behold, the beautiful installation Behold that is now in the collection of the Tate Modern when she was at Tate. And she also invited Sheila to take part in the Kwanju Biennial. So now I will invite you to follow us through the exhibition of Giorgio Andreotta Calò, another beautiful exhibition curated by Roberta Tenconi, who's also with us. And we just passed through the exhibition and then very freely follow the words of Sheila and Jessica and see the show. Thank you very much.
So I'm slightly disbelieving that you can actually hear what we're saying through this. So you'll have to nod and and comfort us so that we know that you can hear us whispering to each other. But I wanted to begin by thanking everybody actually for the opportunity to speak with Sheila today. It's a great pleasure always to hear what you have to say. And thank you to everybody, Nuria, Lucia, and everybody at Engarbicocca for organizing this. And of course, especially congratulations to Sheila on a really remarkable exhibition. I think we've all been waiting to see this work come out into the world more than had happened previously. So this is a really great opportunity. I think probably quite a few people here may not be so familiar with Sheila's work. And in fact, I wanted to begin really with asking you, Sheila, about your own training and background. You studied at two very famous art schools in India, Shantiniketan and Baroda, and also, as you rightly pointed out, spent 5 years at the Kentar School in Bangalore, and then later at the Royal College of Art in London. And your work took a sort of dramatic shift at a certain point from a more two-dimensional practice, we could say, or painting practice into three dimensions. But maybe you can just give some sense of what that training entailed and sort of how your practice developed during that time, to what we really see here now.
Anyway, thank you first, Jessica, for agreeing to be here. It's a great honor to have you here, and particularly so because you are quite familiar with my work, and I look forward to hearing what you have to say about my work. But yes, to talk about my background, I studied at Ken School of Art, a small one-teacher school in Bangalore, India, and I studied there for 5 years, a diploma course, and it was a very important part for me, part of my education, because the teacher, R.M. Harpert, was the one who inspired me to be the artist, the one who seeks, the one who looks, the one who is alert to things around. And I think that was really most crucial mm-hmm. for whatever happened later, that I kept my eyes and ears open all the time and looked around me and always looked for what I had to do from around me, not only internal. But I also got a lot of skills in that school. And so when I went on to Baroda, it was K.G. Subramanian who gave me somehow the basics of visual language in a conscious way. Whatever I did without understanding what a line meant, what a line could do, or what color could do. And so it was he who gave me the basics of that. Mm-hmm. And when he left for Shantiniketan in Vishwabharati Shantiniketan, I followed him, and there I was able to begin somehow my own language in a way. Till then, it was really about strictly about understanding visual language itself. After which, I got a scholarship from the INLAX Foundation. Person Nicola, he was actually quite instrumental in giving me the scholarship to go study in England, which was quite something out of the blue, because you really didn't have that many scholarships apart from the British Council, Charles Wallace. And I studied at the Royal College of Art, and where I studied under Peter Di Francia. Mm-hmm. And that again was for me important from two aspects. One was from the point of view of being outside of your own country, to be able to look back on what one saw, how one looked at one's own country from the distance, not to be within it. So there's a sense of objectivity. Also, some things get more clarity, you mm-hmm. know. The second was that I was able to look at European art in the context, because whatever I had studied was in pictures in a magazine. So to be able to see the art fully, and to also, you know, to understand how that art came from a certain society, I think that was really important. Because when I went back, that was what I had to look at and said, where does my art belong? Mm-hmm. Within my society, in the way I, the language I use, the medium I use. So after I went back, I did continue to make paintings, but few years on, I began to feel the need to find something that justified whatever I was feeling, whatever subject matter I wanted to issue. So which is when I moved to Kaodang. Which we'll, I guess, talk about later.
Which we will definitely talk about, yeah.
That was a long answer to a very short question, I'm sorry.
But perfect, and I think because materials are so key to your work, and I think we'll be talking about that quite a bit as we go along, but to understand this process perhaps of separation in a way, I mean, what you're describing, this ability to step outside perhaps the familiar and mm-hmm. view it with a very different perspective is something mm-hmm. That you described there perfectly. Now, of course, this is a very specific space, so to ground everybody as well, and you know, I've always seen your work in much more intimate galleries, the type of space that we're used to seeing, but I did also want to ask you from the outset sort of how you approached the exhibition here, given the vastness and the lack of walls. And the fact that, of course, it has, you know, no bearing on the sort of more traditional gallery space that you perhaps were more familiar showing in. But sort of how did you spatially begin to rationalize things?
The selection was in dialogue with the curators and in the requirements of the space as well. But my first thought was, I have to reinvent the work. Each of them I have to reinvent. My works have always had elements in them, but they have been always placed inside specifically, space specifically actually. But here I think it had to go a little more beyond that. You know, it was really about holding its own at the same time responding to the space. So mm-hmm. I think each work has been looked at from that point of view.
One of the things that I think really perhaps for those of you who are, you're back to this piece here, or in fact, it's two works, two works sort of forming into one piece. But one of the things that I really began to think much more clearly about, actually, both in revisiting your work before this talk, but then walking through the space and understanding how you'd approached it here, was the degree to which, in fact, your work in and of itself has been so much about defining space or collapsing space or creating boundaries or, mm-hmm. or dislocating boundaries, perhaps. We'll see it as a sort of repeat mm-hmm. motif almost within the work throughout. But it was really actually seeing the way in which you had handled the enormity and, as you say, having to kind of almost reinvent the works within the space that clarified for me how much that's actually part of your language through and through. But the work that we're looking at here, on the one hand, I mean, as many of your works do, have a sort of specific reference point, whether it's materiality or to do with a connection with labor, which is something that I think we'll also talk about as we walk through. But this work, to some sense, derives from the sort of temporary structures that one sees in India for celebrations.
Shamiana or a pandal.
Thank you. Yeah. You have to yeah. correct
that's
all my...
That's the Indian names.
Yes, yeah. But of course, here, disassembled almost, you know, we're witnessing or the assembling or the disassembling. It's a sort of structure in motion. And I can see that we'll have trouble getting people to walk around rather than look at us, but you should walk through the structure and see the other elements that are within it and also appreciate this very dramatic formal dynamic within your work, which again is sort of one of the features that we'll see throughout. But perhaps, Sheila, you can say something about these structures and sort of what, again, this way in which you're drawn to works that have this kind of delineation of boundary almost, or affecting an environment or creating space.
I think what you say about within the space also happens within the work also, because a structure, the shamiana, is something that people gather under. It's a temporary kind of a shelter. And what has happened here is the cutting away of the center of this rectangle. There are two rectangles here. These are the centers which have fallen, and what is left behind are the jagged edges, which are also quite celebratory as buntings. So it is about what's happening within, and then what's happening off with the whole within the space.
Mm-hmm.
So we are dealing with like two centers that have fallen, which and there's a structure on which it has fallen, and there's one which is in a state of ascension, so to say. But I'd be interested to hear how you see the work.
I think what yes, I mean what struck me most was this. This idea of a social space, it's a mm-hmm. collective space, that, you know, we now sort of navigate in such a different way now, I mean, mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. the exterior. I think probably because I was thinking so much about these interior spaces that you've also worked with, sort of creating mm-hmm. Shelter. It was I don't know, somehow the politics of it was something that I was intrigued by, but I can't say that I've put my finger on. But you know, I think of it's a space for a collective of a large number of people. It's a social space normally.
No, what you said about navigating it around now, seeing the away from the center, what should I be under?
Yes,
the center. I think that's quite interesting for me to hear. You know, that we are looking at an event. So I guess in this particular, in this exhibition, this was the only one I tried to be theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
So I allowed that theatricality to happen without taking away from the idea of the work.
Yes.
You know?
Perhaps we can turn our attention this way. Actually, I did want to ask you one more thing about this piece, though, mm-hmm. Sheila, and with some of your other titles as well, the title of this work, mm-hmm. And this is no lie.
Well, there's a pun on the lie, but yes, lie. And the other one is it stands fallen.
Yes.
Both of which have a contradictory, I mean, oppositional meanings.
Within them. Yeah.
That somehow the idea of fallen is gone, you know, like it's finished.
But then
it stands fallen. it has a sense of positivity to it.
And so do you title things after you finish the work, or is it something that's is language part of your process?
Yes, I title it after, and it's a very difficult process. Sometimes more difficult than making the work.
The work. So Stopover, which is the work that we see here, which, you know, may perhaps not initially conjure the idea of an environment or a space, actually in my mind always does, because these stones were originally inside homes, right? I mean, quite an important part of a domestic environment. They're grinding stones that are used to grind spices that Sheila gathered in Bangalore. They'd been removed from the older houses and left in the street as relics of a sort of bygone way of living. And you gathered them together and initially took them to Kochi in India,
yes,
where they were in the first Kochi Biennial.
In the docks, which used to export spices.
Exactly. So you have this sort of connection between the use and the form itself. But again, sort of back to this idea of space, which, as I was saying, I'd never really formed this impression about your work quite so succinctly before. But you know, of course, as we look at these, though, they represent individual households in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the spaces that no longer exist around them, they've been sort of taken out of that environment. And the grid that we see here that you've placed underneath the work originally, and I think, again, it's important for people to understand how much you sort of rethink works. I mean, obviously here, perhaps more dramatically because of the scale of the space, but the work changes so much according to context.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, I mean, there was a direct relationship to its original manifestation in Kochi, the center of the spice trade in India, and so you have this sort of lovely connection to that, and these works were kind of spilling out of a building onto a dock.
So up to the water.
Exactly, yeah. So there's a sort of very direct relationship with this idea of transportation and export. But here you've placed the grid underneath the work, and of course it raises also this dialogue in your work between a kind of modernist tradition. You've got the disassembling of the grid with the stones themselves and then the grid lying underneath it. But perhaps you can speak a little about this kind of relationship between the forms and your intention with that.
I mean, the stones themselves are mostly cuboid. So they have I was very much interested, apart from the history of what they represent, but also in their form itself, that they have this unsculpted but geometric form, unvariable within that. For me, the grid somehow represents a certain given and conscious form. Mm-hmm. And it's also a modernist element, and it's a very deliberate act to put a modernist element in something that's has a different history from where it's coming from, the in terms of cultural history, or of the organic or the you know, nature of the form itself, which is, it's kind of getting to be a cuboid, but never quite, because it's always, you know,
wonky.
Yeah, there's a wonkiness to it. So I had the grid on the walls in Kochi, whereas here I chose to put it on the floor because the movement was more had to be defined somehow, because if I had put the stones directly on the floor, then the whole entire floor of this Navate would have been ground.
Yes.
Literally. But I wanted to define that movement of the stones by having the grid and then breaking that grid.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, I wanted to also in a way have a dialogue with the space of the columns here by colliding the stones against it, and the sense of resistance, you know, mm-hmm. on both sides, and sense of push from the part of the stones and the resistance of the Navate column.
Again, the relationship to the space here. This is a work that is normally seen against a wall. It's normally a work that one perceives, I would say, or in my experience anyway, very much as a sort of painterly.
Yes.
Obviously.
Like a facade.
Yes. Yeah. And here, the solution, which I think was absolutely brilliant, was to create this sort of very simple rebar structure behind in order to support the metal plates that we see. So one would normally see these blue and yellow elements, and you vary those as well, Sheila, right?
Yeah.
In the different installations, as you know, very, very, extremely painterly, sort of found painterly elements on the wall. And again, of course, this very interesting relationship between a reference to whether it might be Mondrian or early modernist painting, with a material that these flattened
tar drums,
yeah, which I think it appealed to you initially through their use by the laborers that you witnessed using these as they were laying the road to also create a temporary habitation.
Temporary shelters.
So these environments, if you get close, you can look inside and see that there's a sort of indication almost of habitation. So you have
this. That unit there is for me the prototype that the workers use. So it's like made up of the drum. The height of the drum is the height of the house. The width and length of the sheet is the width of the structure. So it's not to human proportions.
Scale.
You are accommodating yourself within
the given
what the material dictates.
And these materials, I mean the materials that you actually appropriated and took, are materials that had been used, or are they then materials that you've manufactured they're literally materials that were taken
from?
Yeah,
I actually followed a road worker team around Bangalore and got myself acquainted with them, because initially they thought I was from the tax department. I was trying to, you know, so I had to familiarize myself with them, and I would choose drums, because when there's bitumen inside and they throw it from the truck, it's like really bashed up. So I took what could be retrieved and burnt away the tar. I didn't do it, but I had the tar burnt away, and those that I needed flattened, I had them cut it, and they used their road roller, you know, those heavy machines mm-hmm. which flattens the road, put it under that, then brought them back home on my car and reworked them into to the possible extent that you could flatten them, because they have been burnt. They have a lot of tension in them, so those tensions are hard to get away. So I had somebody called Rehmat who helped me do that.
And this movement, I suppose, is something that I wanted to talk about a bit with some of the other works here as well. From a material, I mean, in this case, I mean, such a fascinating process of it's the container of material. It becomes also associated with the labor that is happening. It mm-hmm. then becomes the container of the humans who are performing the labor. this sort of incredibly layered associations
with
that's
it. Interesting.
But then I suppose what I wanted to ask you about is what happens once you take it away from that environment, and what it's already a complicated thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But then to take it away from that that context and use it within the work, a sort of further alienation almost of the relationship of human to object.
I think that that history I feel is already embedded mm-hmm. in the work. And so now I take it to another field, in a sense, or another viewership altogether, who are looking at it with a certain knowledge of a certain language of use of these, and so the other associations come into play, which is of modernity, and you know, so in a way that's my take on this. But my initial interest in them, I did not, I was very careful not to be, because the minute you use poor materials, you tend to be talking, especially if you're coming from India, it's like you are talking about the poverty in India. Mm-hmm. And I had to be very careful to say that I am not going to talk about that, mm-hmm. because I don't feel I am
able to,
and I shouldn't be, because I'm, it's like a kind of consumption, as Ansel Ulrich once said, consumption of difference.
Yes.
You know, so I was, didn't want that to happen.
Yep.
So, but still sometimes people immediately go to that interpretation. But therefore, somehow taking it away, that the prototype house is there, I don't necessarily emphasize that aspect of the living use, but it's still something that you can seek and you can enter and thing. And I do some transforming elements, like I put these lids which have been made into balls, and I have mica sheets on them that look like water, the same here in these drums. So it I'm taking, trying to
distance
to also give
well.
It another presence without consuming.
And Sheila, can you, and I have never asked you this and I should have, the title
Kage Bangara?
Yes. What does that mean?
Kage Bangara means crow, and Bangara means gold. Crow's gold,
uh-huh.
And the mica is called crow's gold.
Mm-hmm.
Kage Bangara.
We'll walk this way. So perhaps as you walk past this piece, I'm a little afraid to keep everybody around it, so be very careful, but this is a work called Mortar Line, and one of the earlier, but certainly not the earliest, uses of dung in your work, and kumkum, the mm-hmm. the red material that you see that's keeping these dung bricks together. But it's perhaps a good segue from what we just discussed about this, the sort of use of materials, mm-hmm. and you know, I think extremely important to say that obviously this is not by no means an exotic material at all.
Not at all.
In India, dung is used on a daily basis, whether it's in the domestic environment, as a building material. I think that was, you put it so perfectly at the beginning, Sheila, when you were talking about coming back after your training and then thinking, how do I use the materials in my own environment? How do I create that language mm-hmm. for myself mm-hmm. rather than accepting a given language? But perhaps you can talk about these early pieces. There's some earlier works with dung further down, but perhaps the sort of beginning of the use of that material.
Well, this was the first material I picked up after painting, and it was, on one hand, a reason within painting itself, a crisis I had, but it was also a very, it was an inspirational moment when I suddenly felt here is a material that can be sculpturally used, because it's used as cow dung pads, as you will see there, but also that it had a lot of religious and meanings, but my use was really political, because the politics at that time had just begun to use religion as a means of making politics, mm-hmm. and especially around the cow, which, as many of them have, you all might have read, cow has become like a central element, you know, issue of debate, and a lot of violence associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in 92 that I made this, 95 that I made this work, but I started working with cow dung in 92 when the right wing, Hindu right wing, was coming to up front, and we were all feeling this impending horror of what's going to happen, which now is in center stage.
Yeah.
So after 20-25 years, we have it on center stage. And cow dung is a material that is sacred, considered sacred by the some sections of the Hindu community, and it's also used in sacred rituals, but it's also cow dung, it's dung. So I was very interested in these two extreme meanings of it being sacred on the other one hand and it's biologically excrement. So I played with that. I worked with that and it motivated me. It gave me the impetus to continue to work with this material for even now. I think it's still something that interests me to find new ways of using it.
Interesting.
Huh. And it lasts. Nothing happens to it. It doesn't disintegrate.
Unlike perhaps the kumkum that you use, which
and also it's something that's handled by women. That was my first awareness of doing something in a very conscious way as a woman. Till then, I painted, I did everything. It was there were women in my work, and you know, but it was a different kind of consciousness.
Yes. So the work that we're looking at here, which really again sort of defines the space so beautifully, is also using kumkum. You have to get quite close to some of the ends of these beautiful ropes in order to understand what they're encasing, which is multiple threads at the end of which are needles. So it's actually a sort of multitude within one form. If you can imagine, there's a sort of network of veins almost within within these arteries. You can see actually in some of the sections where it's sort of revealed as well.
The what's inside the body of this what's covered up is revealed in certain places like there, you know. And in the tail.
This gesture of labor, which this is as well, and maybe that's an interesting segue from what you were just talking about women's labor that you'd witnessed. I mean, this is an extraordinary effort to produce by hand, and that's also a sort of aspect of your work over the years, the pieces that have required a sort of dedication and time and also a relationship to the material. Please do be careful, sorry. please be very careful as you walk around the piece. But this depth, I suppose, of persistence and commitment to making the work, I can't help but see is also part of the work itself. I mean, this, again, a sort of interest in labor, but in this case it's your labor as opposed to the labor that you've often identified around you. Perhaps Sheila, you can speak to that, or what the how that process is also appearing in your work.
Well, earlier on I made a smaller I know the idea came to me as a kind of a vision, like it does sometimes. and this one was to do it was the scale of it was to be in terms of a room environment, not something that went up on a wall or, you know, which was hung on a wall and trailing on the ground a little bit. But the viewers could move within that, so it was encompassing.
Which is maybe important for people to understand that normally when you would have encountered this work, it would occupy one often quite large gallery, and the lines sort of really form this three-dimensional drawing really that you're in.
It's a sculptural drawing, yes. And I like the ability of this work to be defined just as a two-dimensional if it's against a wall, and to become sculptural as it is on the ground and in the space. And it's very versatile, I guess, in terms of, because it comes out of one small crate and then it expands into this space. But yes, it was labor intensive, and it was something I had to do. I did it. it was very meditative. Because it's something that you did every day and you had to go on and on and on. There was no stopping till you reached the end. So you go into a kind of a meditative way of doing something if you have to work on something for so many hours, and it has to be perfect, and it is using your hands, using working with certain, you know, materials in your hand, viscosity of the paste.
And a skill, presumably. I mean, you're developing a skill.
You develop a skill as well.
I think what you said again comes back to this, the sort of spatial relationship, and I'm thinking of Behold, the work that we acquired at Tate, which is largely made out of threads of hair, which we'll see later on as well. But yes, the scale, of course, creates the space in a sense, or creates
allows for that kind of which is the reason I use that kind of I give myself that kind of a
task.
Yeah.
So we'll walk over here.
I lost you. Hi.
Yet What Remains is the title of this piece, which again speaks to your observation of labor. Mm-hmm. These bowls are the type of instruments that are used
in
building sites.
Yeah, right? To carry construction materials.
So there's a kind of imagined volume to them, no? I mean, the weight or the...
It's also very much attuned to the ability of two hands to hold and to be able to contain material that has a certain weight. I mean, if it's bigger, you will put more into it and you need two people to carry it, whereas these have just about enough volume to carry a certain amount that can be carried on the head or lifted up in your hands and passed on. Like when you do roofing, you have a long line of people and you're passing it on. You're actually throwing it one hand to the other. You're not even touching.
But these, you've specifically made yourself, Sheila, right? I mean, or the color of the metal, the...
They were like selected.
Uh-huh. Over
a period of time, and really the biggest work was also cleaning them because it was covered with a glue that was so hard to remove. But yes, these are not things that I make them do. It is something that the people who are making these banlis are doing on a daily basis. So there are these two men who are sitting there on the ground, on the ground, and they are like using a chisel and a hammer. First they make a kind of a ring with a compass, engrave a ring of a line, and then they use a chisel and hammer, and by hand they are cutting out these things. So, and then they fold these up, and that is scrapped. These are then, these discs that come out are then hand pressed in hand operated machines into these bandlies, and then again beaten by hand to turn the edges so that they're not sharp anymore. So these are processes that exist, and I insert myself into this process. I think it's more about recognizing rather than trying to reinvent something that is in terms of labor.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But I think, and it's a lot of it also has to do with relationships with people.
Yes.
You know, to go there, to meet them, to understand they, you know, that they also kind of, it's a pleasure sometimes for people who do this on a daily basis to meet somebody who's
interested
on looking at it from another. So when I showed them images of photos of what I've taken, even of their own work, they were like, wow, where is this? You know, like it's a kind of looking at giving. It's about relationships as well.
Yes.
And they liked having me come there, and very happy to help. And yeah, but some of them I tried to intervene, but then I realized that in terms of straw surface, some I have, for example, this one here,
square.
The black square on that, which for me was important in the making as well. But I tried to intervene on the surface, but then I realized that this is already saying a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's only about collaging. It's also about, you know, it's about collaging. It's about composing. It's about looking at the colors and the, you know, so, and giving it a sculptural or a more two-dimensional feel to them. But the aspect of the work was already for me there. But I'm curious to hear what you have to say. You saw the one in Icon Gallery,
yes,
which where it was a lot of it was on the wall.
I was going to say, I mean, this is so different because of the nature of this kind of field, of the expansiveness of it. I mean, it's a visually incredibly beautiful piece. I think there's more of a sense of the lightness of the material, strangely, even though it's actually sitting on the ground, and you would think that gravity would give it more of a pull, but the degree to which they're almost like paper cutouts. I mean, that, and being able to visualize the negative and the positive in this way. I think actually I prefer seeing it in this horizontal form. I suppose again I was fascinated by the way in which these the objects, as you say, I mean they've got this relationship to the hand, I think once you know that they've carried a material and they have that purpose, they have this sort of weight to them or sensitivity, I suppose, a touch to them that otherwise
would make it more just an aesthetic proposition.
Exactly.
No?
Yes. There's something incredibly intimate about them, which you wouldn't normally expect to have that relationship to a metal and a form.
I mean, for me, the difficulty was like how not to be too aesthetic with this, because they're so beautiful as they are, you know,
yeah.
The colors they come in. But I think, from the Icon Gallery to this, I think the association of the Bandli coming out of these is far more evident somehow, and more there's a better relationship to that.
Yeah, exactly.
Between the disc and the Bandli to the cutouts.
And even, you know, I think, for me, certainly anyway, it was a process of thinking much more about how did these become rounded? You know, how does the flat become round?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly,
just a sort of sculptural mystery. You know, and of course you imagine what that process might be. But you've described it now, which is very helpful. But it's sort of a magical event in a way. You know, I'd like to talk about your work with. With news media specifically, or with found images, which, you know, in general we have this, although not always. I mean, you've also worked with smaller scale found images, but here we have two examples. It's another over there, where you're working with a found photography in the news media, and then blowing that image up. And quite often, in fact, in this case, it's very visceral, having this kind of three-dimensional quality or sort of image blurred with the ground that we're standing on. There's a huge amount of humor in your use of these found images, which I think the first time I realized that, I found a little shocking almost.
Have some humor.
You do have a lot of humor, but this one, which I particularly love, which is of these lawyers, demonstrating lawyers, no? So you have the sort of very unusual image of men in suits throwing rocks at other men in uniforms, in this case the police, and then the illusion of this sort of material coming out into the space. But I suppose, you know, that there's also a surprising, or I don't know, it seemed to me, struck me certainly, encountering your use of imagery as a surprising dichotomy, perhaps, with the abstraction, obviously, you deal with abstraction in your work, and yet there's always a human quality to it, which I think that there's sort of the unspoken human who's somehow connected to it, whether through the material itself and the labor or the sort of imagined presence of yourself making the work. But in this case, of course, you know, it's the images that you use have people in them. They're often quite, I mean, violence, not necessarily the right word, but there's a kind of energy to them, a movement of
there's
people.
There's a body movement,
yes.
Body awareness.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could speak to sort of what draws you to those type of images, and why, you know, how you see them, and I suppose in relation to your sculptural practice, although they are very sculptural.
Well, it's about looking at newspaper things that come from the media. I mean, I'm not talking about social media. I'm talking about just newspapers because I don't go on to social media so much. But newspapers, I think, it's something that you encounter on a daily basis. And there's sometimes, especially nowadays, when you see images that are very stark, very, all given to you already chewed, and then you suddenly encounter an image which begins, you look at it closely, you begin to read things into it, you know, you find elements in it which are very interesting because they also can progress to another reading of them. And here you have the law enforcers in kind of conflict in a state that we as viewers are watching, you know, so it's in a way it's called in public for that reason somehow, that you are the people who are watching the law enforcers in this sorry state, and that's the media that the lawyers are against, and so I was interested in the idea of a kind of a collapsing mm-hmm. happening again within social terms of what should not be.
Right.
Yeah.
And this sort of triangulation, or even sort of four parties almost with us as part of that as well.
And to think that the person who has taken this photograph is also from the media.
Yeah.
You know, and I found that interesting because I'm always interested also in the position of the photographer,
right,
on one hand, who captures that in reality, and then it is then transmitted back to the people. So there's a lot of generational mediation that's happening, and then you receive it, and then you are supposed to then imagine or what happened.
Interpret what this
so
is.
So you have to visualize somehow,
mm-hmm.
and in this process there is a lot that happens that I'm interested in, those kind of generational shifts that happen with the initial look of the photographer of something who records it for somebody else, which is actually the subject matter of Sanjaya Narrates as well, that line of paintings there.
You can walk and talk over to the piece that you made specifically for here, but I mean, what you're describing, of course, is also this sort of very active process of looking, which I think is behind your process of producing sculpture, but it's also the demand is too heavy a word, but the request of an audience in a way, like to look harder, to look better,
to actively
understand what it is that we're presented with.
Right. A self-awareness, in a way, of the audience.
Yes.
Because the audience is so varied. It can be with somebody in India, somebody outside, and somebody who is aware of the art language, somebody who is not. So I am not addressing one. Now we come to the smelly smell aspect of my work.
Yes, we're hit by an incredible smell.
Smells of my work.
It's a extraordinary piece that you made here, Sheila, specifically. Oh dear, somebody's treading on it. Make sure you don't tread on it. So actually smells even more than it did a couple of days ago to me.
Did it? Oh, you should have been here when we did it. It's when it first came from the factory.
I mean, I've
Pirelli factories.
It's the first time that there's been a gesture within this space that's actually referred back to the labor and manufacturing of this whole this building and its history and the ownership, let's say. So I mean, this is a work made out of rubber, I remember talking to you some years ago when you were working on the Sao Paulo Biennale, mm-hmm. and had investigated using rubber, which didn't work for a number of reasons. But I was wondering, of course, if you came immediately with the desire to work with rubber, given that experience that you'd had years before. Mm. And then perhaps you can speak a bit about, how you then worked with the archive here, I mean, to produce this, which, I mean, it has this extraordinary quality to it. Before, I mean, I was saying, sort of reminds, Moments looks like a skin, perhaps, of a sort of rhinoceros or some, you know, incredible animal. At other points, like a bronze sculpture, it has this incredible reference to depicting drapery, and of course, mm-hmm. being in Italy, it's a, you know, perfect reference, but both art historically, but also in relation to the trade and production here in Milan in this region. But Sheila, maybe you can just talk about how that process came about.
Actually, the rubber I was looking for was the kind of rubber that you see over there in that corner, which is rubber that was made in the Amazon by the people who live in the Amazon from the trees in the Amazon. So I went looking for that rubber in the Pirelli factory. Their raw material came in a hard, dark bundle, which was, you could do nothing with it unless you heated it up. So they gave me some samples as to what they could produce for me. That is after coming here, just a few weeks before, they helped me to find some of these samples. But it's only after I came here and I went back the second time that this person at the factory, who was very enthusiastic, Antonio, who allowed me, who gave me the possibilities of, I asked him for something that is thinner and broader, and he could produce this quite easily. And there were also other things, forms that he gave me, but that would have entailed a different approach. So having seen this, I had to go back to my own inner resources to find a form for it and a methodology of making something with it, which did not entail too much of intervention on my part in the detailing of it. So this wonderful installing team of Hangar, they wove it for me, these stretches. So we have something like, I think, 600 meters here, or maybe less, a little bit less, so which were woven.
And just to explain to people, the sort of unit or the length is the width of one of these sections,
right? Yeah, this is the width of the what came in long strips. And so these were cut and then interwoven.
Yeah.
Diagonal to each other. Not diagonal, perpendicular to each other. And then I thought of this form, and then it's a very big, actually quite big when it is stretched out. So we had to use everybody's hands on in this place to be able to lift
it's heavy.
It. And it's about 250 kilos,
wow.
But it is difficult to hold it, you know. To hold, because you're holding it only in the periphery, so mm-hmm. it's something very big. It's like holding a big carpet, you know,
yep.
Big carpet. So, and it's also a bit stretchy. So, putting it on this was quite. It was an interesting moment.
And the choice to give it this. I mean, obviously, it would appear as a grid were it lying on the ground in a flat form, but to give it this kind of three dimensionality, it's a rather mysterious. We don't quite know what's underneath.
Why would
Was it rising up?
Yeah, but I think these are beautiful surprises that one is lucky to get. I mean, it could have behaved in any way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It could have. I don't know. I mean, it's a risk that you take,
right.
But you also understand you some certain things that you have to anticipate before you do something like this. So whatever I projected, I think it's worked out well, I think. And there's a seed there in the middle, which is the seed of the rubber tree that I picked up in the Amazon forest. So this rubber is very far from
its origin.
From its origin. This is from Thailand, I think. We were told that this is from Thailand.
Uh-huh.
The rubber is from Thailand.
That's amazing.
Oh, sorry. I haven't been here properly since the burning, you know.
Oh, really?
I haven't seen it fully burned.
So in this final room,
I think we should just tell them not to go too close to the frames, especially with the jackets.
Yes, if you could be very
hem of the jacket.
Very careful of the incense work on the table because it's extremely fragile. So here you produced two bodies of work that are perhaps to hang a bicocca scale, no?
Yes.
So these two, do you think of them as one work, Sheila? Or it's right now a piece that's so very referential to the space that we're in.
Exactly. Yeah. It is an architectural reference, but it's a very, it's something that can change shape. It can change proportions.
It's next showing, it might
space.
Be in a very different.
Yeah. But in this space, yes, it is making an architectural
and
reference.
And it's one, I mean, just so you can see in both cases, it's one incredibly long thread of hair, which has been wrapped around and around and around this board. We haven't talked about your use of hair. I mean,
not till now.
Again, sort of a little bit like the dung. It has these two sort of qualities to it. Both, you know, on the head, glorious and you know, a subject of fantasy perhaps, and off the head, disgusting.
Disgusting, yes.
But in this case, it's also, again, connected to commerce, or there's a huge market for hair. Hair is offered as a sacrifice as well.
Yeah.
And then it's also sold. And you've used it both here and in the work Behold that we were referring to, that's in part of Tate Modern's collection, in sort of using these references, but then also as a formal device. And here we have this very specific relationship to the room itself. You can see that the dimension is mimicking the door of this final room. Maybe you want to say something about how you sort of came to this solution, Sheila, and sort of the process of thinking about the specifics of this space.
With this material?
Yes, yeah.
Well, I seem to have an obsession. I mean, it wasn't that I was trying to make a black square again. It just happened that the doorway was kind of a black square. And so I wanted to replicate that form. And also I wanted to actually have the rectangular nature of the entire doorway in here. Perhaps I think in difference to Behold, with, you know, when I was looking at the idea of using hair rope again, I wanted to not, I wanted the massness of it. I wanted the darkness of it. Rather than it holding something, being pulled, or in the singular linear fashion. Mm-hmm. So though it comprises of many lines, it's like a very dense lines, you know. So I wanted that. So I guess, and it kind of. I did many drawings for this space because it's the only space that has walls. You know, why shouldn't I use them? So I was happy to use the walls firstly, and not make it come onto the floor. And as I said, it I like the idea of the intensity that it is made of human hair, all of it, but you just see the
mess,
black shape. But on a closer encounter, you see the lines. It's like going on with the pen in a certain space, you know. I felt that's something that I hadn't explored.
Yeah,
and I wanted to do that.
I think it also. Again, as you're saying, I mean, as a different way of using this material, it has an aural quality. I think that was my impression when I came in too, a kind of muffling. I mean, as you get close to it, there's a way in which it...
No, I haven't tried that. I should do that.
It feels like it sort of affects... It creates a kind of muffled environment almost as you get close to it.
If you want to go close to it...
True.
You wouldn't want to go too close to it.
But, and of course, the piece that you want to go very close to, and I always have to like restrain
and
myself from wanting to touch it, is this work, which is a piece that is made from incense or blocks of incense that did you make all of them, Sheila, or some of them were made by other people?
It was supposed to be made all by myself, but I made them over 3 weeks. But when it came here, they came in pieces.
Some were broken.
So many of them had to be made here by the installing team under my guidance. It entailed firstly to make a form. These mm-hmm. lengthy forms of stretched stainless steel mesh over wood, and to have these pedestals to first decide as to what is the kind of physical space that it occupies, because this is very essential for the incense to burn,
mm-hmm.
Because it needs air from underneath, and after which it's about laying them out. And then burning them individually, and to make sometimes connections so that they catch on and move on in their burning process. So it's again labor intensive, and you're inhaling a lot of smoke, sometimes crying from the smoke. But it's something that's so ephemeral and so delicate, and many times I don't know quite what how the ash will settle down when it does finish burning.
This
it has different, this one. For example, this one here was a bit up like this.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't flat.
So, it
so you don't know how that'll fall, that ash. So it's always a curious moment for me to, like this was already hugging the, it was touching the mesh. And that wasn't. So mm-hmm. the way it fell is also something quite unexpected.
Yes.
And
yeah.
whether they become dark or they become beige colored or white, that's something that's also sometimes
unpredictable. Mm-hmm.
But
I thought what was interesting, I mean, when I've seen this previously, it made me think of sort of cartography mapping, or, you know, it has this sort of macro, micro play to it, and then of course, as you say, the individual elements become these sort of almost individual paintings or sculptures on the surface. Mm. But the broken parts actually then seem to reference something completely different, which is a sort of archaeological site almost, or that was the
Also kind of an aerial view of a whole landscape before
topography.
You.
Topography.
Mm-hmm. Please be careful.
Yeah.
That is, it's like a
city.
A city,
mm-hmm.
And I think in these times it's hard not to imagine that.
Yeah.
Of bombarded cities, of
burnt cities,
cities, and nature also. In that table, I think I have kind of had more nature in mind,
mm-hmm.
more like leaves and
organic forms.
You know, organic forms. So there was sort of thematic. Ness in
the layout,
in the way I did the layout of these, and of course this scale for me is like a lot. I mean, I've not done it on this scale. It's quite big, but then that is what was demanded of this space. I had to do it.
Well, I have to say you rose to the occasion brilliantly. I think it's an incredible exhibition, Sheila. So huge congratulations for that. I know we agreed if people have some questions, well, we're happy to take them, but thank you first of all for
thank you Thank you.